Welcome to The Independent with Scott Atlas, brought to you by The Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to some of our important controversial issues facing society. Today's guest is Harmeet Dhillon. Harmeet is Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division for President Trump. Prior to that, Harmeet founded the Dhillon Law Group, as well as the Center for American Liberty, a nonprofit dedicated to pursuing civil liberties legal claims. Her private law practice career is focused on First Amendment and free speech, civil rights, and campaign and election law issues. She was born in India, lived in London, and then moved to the Bronx in New York, later attending Dartmouth, where she became editor-in-chief of the Dartmouth Review and attended University of Virginia School of Law. Harmeet and I have a conversation about the important work being done in the Trump administration to ensure freedom in America today. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Okay, Harmeet Dhillon, welcome. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Great to see you. I'm going to jump right in and start with the civil rights issue because that's your world now. And I want to start by asking, tell us what you think are the most important sort of civil rights issues right now on your plate.
Well, thank you, Scott, for having me. It's been a pleasure to work with you over the years and talk about the job that the president asked me to do. What I first want to say is that the Civil Rights Division has so many different components in it. There's over a dozen different sections that we work on and one that's about to be announced. And so every day we are literally issue spotting and then fighting for the American people, really filing new lawsuits, filing letters to different governments and different individuals, and working directly with the president, the attorney general, and her entire team here. And so it's a huge job. And so I would say on any given day, I'm probably dealing with about half a dozen different civil rights statutes and issues. So today so far, I had correspondence with, somebody who represents one of the American universities we're negotiating with. I've given some legal advice to people about issues. I have met in the last week with attorneys general and had conversations with them about outstanding issues in their states, including ancient consent decrees involving education and voting and things like that. We are constantly back and forth with the Solicitor General's office, which is down the hall here at DOJ, about briefs that we're filing in the United States Supreme Court and in courts of appeals, weighing in on the United States position on issues ranging from education to employment to disability to voting rights, and you name it. And so it's just a huge freewheeling job. And I'm just, it's a constant challenge.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. Let's start talking about some of the issues that overlap with what you did before you were in that position, which, of course, you brought legal challenges against UC Berkeley over free speech, against Antifa organization, variety of things. I want to start talking about free speech. To me, free speech is the essential freedom. You can't have any kind of freedom if you don't have free speech. You can't even have really freedom of thought if you think about it. So let's talk about, it's obvious that these free speech issues are still prominently problematic on campuses, to say the least. You know, TPUSA at UC Berkeley was a recent issue out where I live in California. What are the sort of what exceeds the limits of free speech, and what is happening with the misunderstanding of what free speech really is in the United States, particularly on campuses?
Well, that's such a great question. You know, my history on this issue goes back to my years in college, which is, I'm dating myself a little bit, but it's 40 years ago that I went to college at Dartmouth. And when I arrived on campus, we were in the middle of free speech issues there on the campus. And I got involved with a college newspaper, the Dartmouth Review. My predecessors included Dinesh D'Souza and Laura Ingraham, prominent commentators today on these First Amendment issues. And so we really got into it with the administration over issues, and students were penalized by the university, by the college, for their speech. And we had ACLU lawyers back then who stood up for free speech on campus, represented us, and went to court and took on our college, and we won. And that's, you know, my dad and both my grandfathers were doctors, and I was pre-med when I went to Dartmouth, and that incident and that experience actually pushed me towards the law, because I just found it to be incredible that teenage students could, with the help of a great lawyer, go into court and equalize the odds and take on a huge and venerable institution, Dartmouth College, and win on speech issues. And so that really changed the course of my life very early on. But then when I became a lawyer after getting my degree at UVA and took on First Amendment issues throughout my career, which I've done both on religion as well as assembly and, you know, freedom of association and the press and free speech as an individual, it's hard to articulate bright line tests. And so actually I've gone and testified in Congress and done briefings with members of Congress and, you know, even Democrat and Republican, they both want me to come out and say, Harmeet, can you just give us a speech code that tells the students and tells the professors what they can and cannot do? And the answer is no, I really can't do that. I don't want to do that. I think we want to really call balls and strikes, but really erring on the side of free speech, because generally speaking in the United States, the antidote to speech that you don't like should be other speech. It should
That's
be persuasion,
exactly right.
Right? And so we don't really want to be the speech police. And what most Americans, and I'm an immigrant and I understand this very well because the country I came from, India, has very different laws. Most Americans don't understand that in the rest of the world, there's no First Amendment. There's no First Amendment in Canada, and there's no First Amendment in the UK. That is certainly the case.
Certainly
where,
the case. We're seeing the result of that right now.
I mean, you can get arrested for your tweets in Germany, in the EU, in Canada, and in the UK for being mean to people. And that's so interesting because our entire sort of Bill of Rights jurisprudence flows from the English legal tradition, but they abandoned it a long time ago. And so it is unique in America that people can stand up and say the most heinous, abhorrent, offensive things, wear offensive symbols. The American Civil Liberties Union, which I used to be a member of, has gone into court and won the right of Nazis to literally march in cities and share their abhorrent views. And we protect that in America. And I want to protect that in America. It is
right. Of course, there's no point. Free speech is not for speech that you like. I mean, there's no point. You wouldn't need a law about free speech. It's free speech is for making sure that people can say things that you don't approve of.
That's absolutely correct. And so, you know, what we do at the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division, which is charged with enforcing the nation's hate crimes laws, is whatever we're going after on a hate crime basis involves somebody's typically violent action or property defacing action in connection with their views or their speech. So that line, if I have to draw a line, is that line ends when somebody else's liberty or safety or property is either threatened or actually injured. And so we go after people who are in this particular modern era, unfortunately, after October 7th, 2023, has involved firebombing Holocaust victims, shooting members of the Israeli diplomatic corps,
okay,
know,
but
defacing
are,
houses
yeah.
of worship. Those are the types of things that we take action on that
right.
are related to speech.
Yeah, you're making a very clear and important point here, which is that it's not really the words. I mean, we're in an era where there's a whole generation or more of people who have been convinced that speech is injurious. Speech is a weapon. Speech itself, the words themselves, the so-called misinformation era, all of the stuff overlaps. But really, speech is not violence, in my view, and I'm not a lawyer, so I'm sort of asking this question.
Right.
It really, is there really such a thing as hate speech? And I don't really understand this claim that hate speech is a violation of the law.
Well, you're
That's
correct.
Still just words.
Yeah. So it's funny that like a number of journalists on the national news networks, people are paid millions of dollars to spout their views online and on our TV sets, have come out and said, well, hate speech is not protected by the First Amendment. Well, it absolutely is. Your hateful words or your hateful symbols are protected by the First Amendment, generally speaking. with very few exceptions. That the exceptions would be if they're coupled with a punch, a kick, a stab, and a shooting. And so,
or if it's defamatory, right? I mean,
or if it's, or if it's defamatory, or if it is fraudulent or false in such a way that a person relies on it to their detriment. I mean, there are a number of very clearly articulated elements. And even then, the First Amendment remains a defense to so many crimes, offenses, and so forth. So when we are bringing these cases, we have to literally go through a very sophisticated analysis and then eliminate potential defenses and look at it carefully and then decide if there is a case that you could bring that could survive a motion to dismiss or survive, you know, grand jury inquiry or survive a beyond a reasonable doubt standard in a criminal case. So these are the judgment calls that we make every day. And that is why a broad swath of viewpoints and even symbolism that people find offensive are protected in this country. And, you know, that dates back to our founders who made it so, which I think is very wise. And again, our response to that as citizens is more speech. And there are plenty of venues for that in America, thankfully.
That's right. Is there a difference in the concept of free speech on a university campus versus somewhere else?
Yeah, so let's talk about that. Now, the typical, let's call it a public university campus. Let's call it UC Berkeley. First of all, the First Amendment generally doesn't cover most spaces, if any spaces, on a private university campus. There is a concept about federal funding and so forth, but, you know, let's set that aside. Let's say it's UC Berkeley. Now, UC Berkeley has some public speech spaces like Sproul Plaza, and then it has a lot of limited purpose public spaces under First Amendment analysis, and then it has a lot of private spaces. So you don't have full free speech rights in the mathematics theater auditorium where someone's trying to teach you calculus. You don't have it in some hallways. You do have it in some hallways. And you totally have it in front of a Sproul Plaza where it's sort of a public forum. So you have to know what space you're talking about. It is not legal for a group or an individual to drown out the ability of a student to obtain their education in those spaces where the primary purpose of that space is pedagogical. So teaching institutions in the classroom itself, that's not a free speech forum. Now,
okay, so this happens,
may have academic
way,
freedom, but yeah, you know, that's a different concept.
Right. So at Stanford Law School, maybe a year ago or so, a federal judge was drowned out by students. And that's an example of not a student's free speech. I mean, the students were blocking the learning of other students there. And they were stopping the judge from speaking.
Right.
Is that who's violating what there?
So that's all private. Like Stanford is a private institution. The space is private. Stanford has a right to exclude or include different viewpoints. I would argue that Stanford, if Stanford were being academically honest, I'm sure it has a code of conduct for students, and that code of conduct, which is a contract, prohibits students from interfering with the academic discourse of speakers or other students. So if you were being honest, you would discipline those students who interfered with the pedagogical method or message of the speech or the speaker and discipline them for that. That's what could have happened at Dartmouth in many instances. But that's not a First Amendment forum because it isn't public in nature, and the government didn't have anything to do with that.
I see. So the argument, you sort of alluded to it, but as a taxpayer myself, we know that, yes, there are private and public universities, but of course, I think everybody knows that some of these universities that are private take hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars per year in various ways from the federal government. But because they're so-called private universities, they're really different from a UC system or something, public university.
They're different in the First Amendment analysis, but they're not different in the following way. Whenever a institution of higher learning takes federal funding, they're accountable to the federal agencies that give them money. If you're taking federal funding for your agricultural program or your math program or your vaccine research program, and you're discriminating on the basis of race or gender or other prohibited characteristic, the agency that gave you money, be it the Department of Education, the NIH, the Department of Defense, the Department of War, Department of Justice can investigate you for that. And that's not a First Amendment issue. That is simply a contractual issue involving federal funding grants. And so that is why the United States has the ability for over 6,000 institutions of higher learning, just about everyone in the United States takes some form of federal funding, either in Pell Grants or certainly direct funding for their research. And then they're accountable to those institutions that give them money for what they did and did not do. And if they're in violation of federal law, not just on the First Amendment, but on any aspect, then their funding can be revoked after a proper inquiry and process.
So you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, it's not just that they're accountable to the work done with those grant monies. They're accountable in a general sense in all, say, constitutional law arguments, or they can't get that money. In other words,
that's the position of the United States. So let me just put it a little bit more clearly.
Okay.
On an annual basis, at a minimum, and more frequently, according to some of the settlements that we've reached, schools are certifying when they receive this money that they're in compliance with federal law. Broadly,
you're
not qualified to get the money if you're not in compliance with federal law, and so that includes admissions. That includes hiring of faculty and staff and how you protect them from anti-Semitism and DEI and discrimination on campus. And so you may say, oh, well, gosh, this grant for how we design rocket engines has got nothing to do with our, anti-Semitism over here. Well, no, it actually does, because you made a certification to the government. And if your certification is false, you are not eligible for the federal funding anymore. And so that is why we have had such broad-ranging inquiries into institutions of higher learning in this country.
Right. So, for instance, if somebody has an NIH grant to study some kind of disease, but in another part of their campus, they're violating some federal law on something, discrimination, admissions, whatever, that NIH grant can be revoked.
That is correct. And we, consider compliance with federal law the table stakes. It is a necessary but not sufficient criterion for obtaining federal funding.
Okay. What about, let's shift into speech that is on social media and so-called private companies regulating what some people call as speech. You know, obviously Twitter is the key example of something like that. There's a different set of circumstances for what is legal and illegal. It's a private company. Well, can you explain that? This is always a subject of confusion for me and probably others.
Well, look, I have a difference of opinion with the United States Supreme Court's most recent precedent on this issue. As you know, Scott, from our prior work together when I was in private practice, I sued Twitter during the Biden administration on behalf of a prominent conservative influencer lawyer named Brogan O'Hanley. And it turns out that our federal government, and I didn't even know this at the time when I filed this lawsuit, but they targeted me and they targeted many other prominent conservatives who spoke out about controversial issues involving elections or, numerous other issues. And so what happened was Twitter got instructions from secretaries of state who are working together in concert with private entities, including lobbying firms, consulting firms, the National Association of Secretaries of State. There was the Stanford Observatory and there was some other like campus projects that basically analyzed who were the dangerous speakers online regarding election issues and what have you. And then they compiled lists. They transmitted those lists to these governments, state governments. State governments told Twitter, was called Twitter at the time, block these speakers, take them down, ban them. And they did that. Now, that's where your Twitter as a private entity becomes a tool of the government. And in my opinion, and what I argued in court, is that that converts the government action into a First Amendment violation, because the government acted and the government forced and coerced, really, and that's what Twitter would say today, coerced these private speech platforms into taking action. That's what Mark Zuckerberg has said, no friend of conservatives with regard to Instagram and Facebook and other platforms similarly. We're all targeted. In my opinion, That's government action, and that's a violation of the First Amendment. What the United States Supreme Court did not go so far as to rule that way, and I think that's a mistake. In the Murthy versus Missouri case, they kind of gave them a free pass, and they said it isn't happening anymore. They dodged the issue. At some point, the court's going to have to confront this, and I would have actually, in one of the defenses used in my case was what's called Communications Decency Act Section 230, which is a 1996 law. When the internet was young, we didn't have laptops like we're using right now, and we dialed up on AOL to get to the internet and communicate in some very primitive fashions with each other. And that was giving the very then nascent and new industry of the internet some legal protection from being taken down according to what users uploaded and communicated with each other. Now, today it's very different because, as I just mentioned, the example, Twitter, X, Instagram, what have you, the officials and the executives of these companies have the ability to shape what you see.
Right.
They produce an algorithm. They can block certain people from speaking. They can filter certain content if they wish. And in fact, they're required to do this in most of the world. In most of the world, some of the most hateful speech that I get attacked with every day, telling me to go back to my country, I was born in India, calling me slurs based on my gender and my sex and my background, my skin color, my looks, that's illegal in most of the world. And X and these other companies, they have to filter that content out. But in America, we have a free speech regime here, and very little of that speech should be filtered by the government, certainly. And yet the court has not gone that far. So I think Communications Decency Act Section 230 really requires Congress to step up and amend it and bring it up to date, because there's a line where if you're Verizon and two people are talking smack about each other, on Verizon, like, what's Verizon supposed to do about that? They're just simply a common carrier. But if you're X calling balls and strikes and allowing certain speakers to speak on a topic and not others, I would argue that that should not be protected by CDA 230. That should be subject to defamation, potentially other kinds of liability. I'm just giving that as an example. And so,
sure.
That's the argument I made. I'm not saying that's my position today because I'm in the government now. I don't represent private parties, but that's the argument that is made, that when you cross over from being a platform and into a publisher, perhaps different rules should apply. But for now, the Supreme Court has said that Communications Decency Act Section 230 protects just about all of those decisions editorially made by content carriers and providers.
Mm-hmm. I just want to point out something that no one really talks about, to my knowledge, which is that it's not always that the government was behind the censorship of what was called Twitter or Facebook. I think in some level, that was an excuse. This is just my opinion. But when I was in the Trump administration, I was taken down as the advisor to the president. I was taken off of Twitter. My interviews were taken down from YouTube. You would think the public should know during an emergency what the advisor to the president was saying in a free country. And these were not demanded to be taken down, obviously, by the Trump administration, which was the administration in charge. This was done by the people at Twitter, at Facebook, at YouTube. And I think that's sort of an excuse that somehow the government was pressuring them. I don't buy it all the time. I think it's happened, clearly did happen under the Biden administration in that case you referred to, but it wasn't always that.
But let me push back a little bit. There's governments and there's governments. Okay. So let's talk about today right now. Today, I'm part of the Trump administration, 47 administration. I am constantly under attack by governments in the United States, state governments.
State governments.
So that's what happened even in some instances, the Biden administration colluded with and cooperated with state governments. But in some cases, these state governments, all the big tech companies were, some of them still are, headquartered in California.
Sure.
So suddenly, the government, the very powerful government of the sixth largest economy in the world, comes to you, the attorney general comes to you and says, that's a nice multi-billion-dollar corporation you have there. Sure would be a shame if something were to happen to its, tax status, or there would be an investigation into its hiring practices. There's a coercive element where even a powerful state government starts to investigate you and you're Mark Zuckerberg and you're living in Palo Alto and you don't really want that. So you go along and get along. That's what happens in the real world. That's the thuggish reality of government power.
Yeah, that's a fair point, as they say in trials. Okay, you touch on a couple things I do want to keep going on. One is this, what I call Orwellian Stanford University project called the Internet Observatory, that was focused on what they call misinformation, but it's really censorship. I'm going to echo something you said earlier in a different way, which is the solution to misinformation, in my opinion, is simply more information. Mm-hmm. We're a free country. You have to assume that people can think. We're not dogs and cats. We're actually human beings, which are defined by the ability to reason. But this is a very poisonous thing because the Stanford Internet Observatory, as you're well aware, has been dissembled or taken down. But there's something else going on, which is a cyber project on a different name. And in many people's opinions, it's sort of the same thing. Is there a potential role of, you know, the federal government, of course, funds a lot of things at Stanford, not just NIH and whatever, but probably the Stanford Cyber Project and all these other things. Is there anything going on, or you probably can't comment on something that's active, but is there any role of the federal government in looking at that? Because this censorship is really poisonous and destructive, in my view, to what the public, there is a reality. The public gets its information from somewhere. And it's through the media, it's through the internet. And now we have people devising, more sophisticated AI tools specifically to improve, in their words, censorship. What's going on with that? And what is the sort of, is there a potential role here of federal government in fixing the flow of information here?
Well, first of all, it's my personal opinion, I'm not speaking for the government here on this answer, that zero federal dollars should be spent to work on censorship regimens. It's not necessary. There's plenty of obnoxious billionaires out there who are more than willing to fund these projects, and I think we should let them fund them. But if they have to occur, that's speech. It's speech to fund censorship. That's a form of speech. And in fact, you should know that as the United States has been cutting off federal funding to these institutions that are clearly in violation, until sometimes a federal judge tells us we can't temporarily, some of those grants are never going to get turned back on. And they include grants involving DEI promotion and grants involving censorship. I mean, this is a pro-free speech administration. And so if there are artifacts like that out there, I'm actually going to look into that after we're done here today and see the extent to which our United States are still funding those projects, the most notorious projects we're aware of. But like to your point, so much of what these institutions of higher learning do is shape-shifting. They are keenly aware of the prevailing winds and sometimes simply change the front-facing personnel. They change the title. They call it something else. And they think that they can just keep doing it. And then there are just people dedicated in our society who went to college in recent decades and think that censorship is not only okay, it's actually essential to their mental health and their survival.
Right.
And they think it's perfectly reasonable to take federal funding and use the tax dollars that other people are paying because they're not paying it because they're like, you know, not, they don't have productive jobs outside academia and use that money to censor their citizens. I mean, the AI example that you give is a very good one because I'm no computer scientist, but you know, it's garbage in, garbage out. I know that much from my days at in college and my early programming days. And so it is absolutely scary the extent to which these models and their built-in biases can ultimately filter the average lazy citizen from being able to see the truth. And, you know, as it is, this the national news media's slant is so biased that if all you did was watch, you know, 10 years ago, the CNN and the three networks, you would never get a clear picture of what's happening in America. And today, if you just compared one network to the other, it's just so radically different. You really have to have more than one news source. I think personally, the modern era of being able to look online and get different viewpoints is very refreshing. I feel like I'm more well-informed as a citizen today than I could have been 5 years ago and 10 years ago. Well, that's because I'm intellectually curious. If I'm intellectually lazy and I'm simply consuming NPR, I'm going to get a very biased view of what is happening in our world.
Right. I think that if nothing else, regardless of accuracy or not, the more information, the better, because it dilutes the control. And no one should be in charge of the information, in my view. No one should be given this arbiter of truth status in a free country. And yes, it's more difficult to discover truth, but it's essential. I don't understand. The laziness has to take a back seat in that. That's just my opinion. I want to ask you about, you mentioned this shape-shifting of universities, and there's nowhere that's probably more an exemplar of that than in this idea that DEI things have been banned, or the universities have been warned, or funding's been withdrawn. Yet there's still, from a layman point of view, and I work at Stanford, of course, so I'm very interested in this. It seems to me that a lot of these universities have just changed the names or sort of obscured what they're doing. What is going on with that from your point of view?
Well, Scott, you're absolutely correct. And so, for example, it was very blatantly the case that there would be a DEI office, or let's call it housed under the Title IX office or whatever, at every institution of higher learning taking federal funding, which is almost all of them. And then what happened is, you know, United States Supreme Court came out with a couple of different rulings, as Students for Fair Admissions is one, Ames versus Ohio is another, that basically said that, guess what? All Americans have rights. All people who are attending these institutions have rights, not just some of them. And so suddenly it really became illegal to officially discriminate. But instead of, but this is the, and this is the anthropological analysis I want to share with your viewers, is that there are a couple of generations now of young people, and now middle-aged and older people, who have made their entire careers out of this race hustling,
right,
gender hustling, diversity hustling, and add in sexual orientation hustling. So, you know, they majored in gender studies or whatever, and you can't get a job in the real world with that. I mean, who's going to pay you for that? So your job is going to be being the diversity officer of a corporation or a American institution of higher learning or some school or whatever, some public institution. You're going to get paid $250,000 or more to, you know, like spout nonsense about quotas and, you know, equity instead of equality. Illegal. So what are you going to do with all those people? I mean, they're real people. And so friends of these people in these institutions are like, well, how can Susie, who comes over for dinner every Sunday, keep her job? So we changed the name to Office of Inclusion. We changed the criteria to include, you know, sort of race adjacent or gender orientation adjacent criteria and admissions. We try to keep the same regimen, but we try to disguise it from government scrutiny. But guess what? For every institution doing that, we have whistleblowers on campus. We have great new genre and cadre of creative independent journalists who are telling us online this is happening. And so I read on X every day, what's going on? And if this hustling is happening, I've literally been in negotiations with some institutions of higher learning, and it turns out that I realized that, you know, UNC has got some far-flung campus in the mountains that's got the same people doing the same stuff, rebranded it. I call the chancellor, I send a letter to them, and I say, what's going on? I thought you told us you got rid of this stuff, you dismantled it, and you're still eligible for federal funding. You just certified that last week. And usually, we get immediate action. We usually get people getting fired, the things getting taken down. And I want to be fair to the board of trustees of many of the public institutions. They realize what's at stake because their institutions cannot survive. They don't have big endowments. They rely on federal and state funding, and they cannot survive without being in compliance with federal law. They're usually the fastest and the most compliant to say, sorry, we're not perfect. We don't have our eyes everywhere. We fired that person who did that. Please do not defund us. And then you have some of the venerable older institutions, the Stanfords, the Harvards, the, you know, you name it. They have a big endowments. And so they have faculty that they have, first of all, very radical faculty. Second of all, mixed bag of trustees. And there are different viewpoints there. And so there, some of them are in resistance mode still. There's a lot of litigation going on. I'm not going to comment on that. But eventually, I think it's going to shake out that the United States Supreme Court precedents that we are trying to enforce are going to win the day. And they're going to have to decide, do you want federal funding? Or do you want to keep doing things in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s ways? Those are the choices.
Yeah, I mean, this is great to hear, and I'm personally, because I know you, very happy that you're in this position because you don't just give up. But I'm concerned from a naive outsider point of view that I'm wondering what will happen after President Trump administration is finished with these things. Now, yes, you're saying there could be or eventually will be Supreme Court decisions on some of these things. But is it true, or am I too cynical at this point, that many of these things can be reversed, or the next administration could look the other way, if not explicitly, simply reverse these things and allow that to happen? Or is there a durable solution to these kinds of things?
Well, you are very correct to be concerned about that. Politics and the political outcomes definitely make a huge difference in law enforcement. There's no question about that. I think a lot of Americans are waking up when they see some of the lurid examples that are being dragged into the press on what's going on these campuses and what their federal tax dollars are funding. People are having a hard time buying eggs. You know, people are having a hard time. We're talking about mortgages that people can't afford. I think a lot of Americans are questioning why their tax dollars are going to support a Harvard with a $50 billion plus endowment. Why are we subsidizing that? Why do we need to? You know, maybe a different question as to why your local community college gets a subsidy so that people of different backgrounds, or maybe even better yet, there's been a big focus in the Oval Office with the president on vocational schools and training people for practical skills that they can use, which certainly doesn't include, you know, being a race hustler for your career. So that is definitely going to be, I think, an ongoing conversation nationally, is the extent to which we can afford, while we have a broke Social Security, we have a broken Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, and we have an open border that we're still paying for, even though people are self-deporting in record numbers and so forth. Like, can we afford this? But, you know, absolutely, the next administration could just look the other way and say, hey, here's a bunch of money. We're not going to enforce Students for Fair Admissions, Ames versus Ohio. So elections do have consequences.
The other related question to me is, are these some of these big universities or colleges, are they playing a delay tactic, or is that's really not happening? In other words, we know that the legal system is slow sometimes. And if you wait and wait, you know, before you know it, President Trump is out. I mean, there's only a couple of years left, really. Is that going on, or the delay is not, they're not able to delay because people like you are forcing the issue?
Well, let me tell you this. First of all, the president nominated me in December. I was confirmed fairly early on in April. The AG got here a few weeks earlier than me, General Bondi and a couple of other colleagues here, but many of my colleagues are still getting confirmed. But I'm in charge of the civil rights work, and I can tell you that in the less than 8 months that I've been here, we've been extremely aggressive on these issues. I speak with the Secretary of Education regularly. I speak with the President and the Attorney General regularly on these issues. It is a signature priority of the first year of this administration to reach some landmark deals. The deal that we reached with Columbia this summer is a landmark. It is a landmark that they gave back money. They paid the highest anti-Semitism class action settlement brought by the EEOC in history. They made historic changes even before we agreed to get to the table with them. And they made some permanent changes to their governance. And this is going to leave lasting marks over there. I think that's very important. I think we're close to a resolution with Harvard. There's a couple of outstanding issues over there. A judge just entered an order recently on the UC system, which we're going to have to analyze and deal with and see the extent to which we can continue trying to obtain justice for the crown jewel in California's education system, the UC system. Mm-hmm. But there's all over the country, schools are self-policing. I'm so pleased to tell you that I get emissaries in my conference room from lawyers and their consultants and their deans asking for meetings. And I haven't even investigated them. They come in and they say, you know, Ms. Dillon, AAG Dillon, we'd like to show you our homework. We'd like to show you what we've done to comply with Students for Fair Admissions. We'd like to show you that we had some problems on our campus and we're remedying them. So please give us a clean bill of health. Don't cut us off. That is happening because this administration out of the box took such a strong stand. So I don't think any university administrator in America can, and we aren't even a year in. I mean, I'm not even eight months in, can sit on their laurels and say, oh yeah, we're just going to outweigh this. No, I mean, there's going to be real pain. I don't think, for example, my alma mater for law school, a great institution at University of Virginia, $1.3 billion in federal funding every year. Most of that goes to the medical school and the, you know, basically providing health as a third-party payer. Can that institution and can others like it, University of Michigan, UC System, can they afford 3 years of a cutoff of federal funding when we litigate this? I don't know. A lot of people what happens in the real world, and I've had this conversation with some of these Ivy League institutions. Oh, you know, Harmeet, what's going to happen to the cancer research? I said, well, not to worry. I have 10 schools lined up to take those researchers and that money. It's not that the research isn't going to happen. It's not going to happen at Harvard. It's not going to happen at, you know, fill in the blank institution. So that's kind of a false premise. The research will continue. The money will flow. It will just flow to institutions that respect our federal laws. And we have 3 more years to go in this administration. And, you know, we'll see what happens after that.
Thank you for listening to part one of my discussion with Harmeet Dillon, Assistant Attorney General for the Civil Rights Division for President Trump. Part two soon to follow.